Hello and welcome to a mini series of podcasts designed to raise the issues facing all government organisations to tackle legacy IT and move towards digital transformation. I'm Simran Sahota from the Government Digital Service, and across three podcasts, I'll be delving into real-life examples with professionals from across government. You'll hear the good, the bad and the ugly, and get practical advice on best practice. Each podcast is broken into three elements: technology, process, and people implications.
This podcast focuses on the support leadership requires to address the legacy IT. It's important to look at the whole picture so that the cause of the problem is solved. To speak on this, we have Malcolm McKee, Tom Beckett, and Beverly Yanjo. Over to our panel. Please can you introduce yourself and tell us about your role and experience in government?
Yeah, hello, I'm Malcolm McKee, Chief Technology Officer at DEFRA. And I joined DEFRA just over 4 years ago, having done a similar role in EDF Energy. And relevant to this, I've spent much of the last 2 years talking about legacy IT and technical debt and helping senior leaders within DEFRA and across government to understand the challenges and how we might resolve them.
Hi, I'm Tom Beckett. I'm the head of spend assurance at GDS, the Government Digital Service. I have a team of people who work with all of the government departments to ensure that the IT that they purchase is of the right standard and they aren't locked in, and they get to buy kind of the best stuff in the best way.
Hi, I'm Beverly Yanjo. I'm a commercial specialist in the complex transaction team in Cabinet Office. I joined the civil service 18 months ago. Before that, I spent over 20 years in commercial, 5 years in the sort of corporate environment, 15 years in consultancy across a range of sectors from aerospace and defence through to hospitality, public sector, and across a lot of categories, including IT. One of the consultancies I worked in was focused on implementing ERP across different organisations.
Tom, you held a critical role in the preparation of SR20 legacy IT bids across government. So in the bid process, how did you translate technical needs to non-technical senior leaders?
Yeah, I think that can often be an issue. One thing that I will say, especially in the kind of legacy space that translates well to all senior managers, is the notion of risk. Risk is something that everybody in the senior civil service understands. And I think in the legacy space, the understanding that you're not only kind of holding risk with some of the legacy IT that you've got, but you're also unaware sometimes of the risk that you're holding there as well, which I think can send shivers up the spine of most kind of senior people. And the kind of potential outcomes when something goes wrong can be massive.
And Beverly, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. How can we explain the risks of technical debt as urgent to non-specialist leaders, especially when everything else on the budget allocation table is presented to us as urgent?
How I would sort of explain technical debt, it's really when you prioritise speedy delivery over doing something in the right way, which eventually leads to rework, which causes significantly more problems than if you would just get it right in the first place. I think technical debt, it frustrates staff. They can't perform their job properly, or they feel they can't perform their job properly. It's demotivating. It means that the organisation can't run as effectively as it should be. And it can lead to turnover of staff and a loss of critical knowledge within that, if you've got sort of a high level of staff turnover. And I think basically it's important to get across that prevention is far better than cure. So, legacy IT systems, the longer you keep them in there going for as long as possible, they become disproportionately expensive and unpredictable. And this opens you up to sort of cyber vulnerability, as well as sort of challenges around keeping the business operating effectively. And I think sometimes we've got a sort of habit of keeping things going as long as possible, which just makes it even more difficult when you need to sort of then switch to a new solution.
Yeah, as Bev was talking just now, I started thinking about how we often end up using analogies. And I don't know whether my colleagues have ever delved down into using car analogies, but we always end up there when talking to senior managers and talking about, you've got a car and you have to put fuel in it, but then you also have to You have to maintain it and MOT it and tax it. And these translate to some of the risks we've been talking about. So just putting fuel in it is one thing, but if you put off taxing and insuring it, then you're starting to run a legal risk. And if you put off servicing it, then you're actually running an operational risk. And the more years you start kicking that operational risk down the line, then the more you're running that risk. So I find, you know, translating it into analogies that people understand is quite powerful. That said, I think it's really important to express the risks that Tom was talking about earlier in business terms. And we often find ourselves talking about data centers and applications and networks. And actually, it's difficult for a business audience to visualize that. Part of the stories we talk about are if we talk about unpatched vulnerabilities leading to a cyber attack, like a ransomware attack, then we've got examples of where other people have had ransomware attacks across the public sector, across the private sector. And we can talk about people not being able to work or losing critical data, systems being down for a long time. And it just helps the business audience to visualize that. I think the other sort of really powerful stories we tell are the ones where it prevents people doing their work either at all or very effectively. A good example from DEFRA is that we have a network of vets, you know, veterinary surgeons that do animal testing on our behalf. And it should be really easy for them to send those tests in, but actually they have to use a really clunky application that only works on a really old version of Microsoft Windows, which means they have to keep an old PC in the corner of their office. And some of them have to buy those on eBay because it's such an old version of Windows. And this might lead to, you know, vets just deciding to not work for us anymore because they can't handle it. So it's those sort of stories which bring the real world impact of legacy IT and technical debt to life that we've got to rely on.
I think there's some great examples there, Malcolm. You know, I think people, it's hard to appreciate what an impact it can have on someone who is using something every day if it's not efficient and it makes their life very difficult. That's really demotivating. I think there's some really good examples you've used there.
I wonder, Tom, during the SR20 legacy bid prep work that you led on, did you find, or what did you find, were some of the factors that prevented leaders from prioritising investment into transformation?
I think inevitably there's competing priorities, and, you know, like, we can't underestimate that when we're looking at kind of what our priorities are in the sort of technology space and in the legacy space. I think, though, that as has kind of come clear from what both Malcolm and Bev have said, the longer you kind of leave these problems, the worse they get. So, you know, the sooner that you can start recognizing technical debt, that goes right to the beginning, really, kind of thinking about when you get a new asset, like getting it onto the system, understanding what that asset is, when it's going to need to be updated, how you're going to, you know, kind of keep on top of that. If you do that on day one, then kind of keeping it updated is a relatively simple thing to do and not hugely costly, and you can build that into your sort of day-to-day processes. Whereas if you kind of just buy something and then effectively forget about it and don't monitor it and kind of keep an eye on it, then gradually all of this sort of this debt just grows and you're unaware of it until you do like a large scale audit of all of the kind of IT that you're running or when something goes wrong. So the much more sort of simple way of dealing with this is to understand kind of from day one how you run an organization that minimizes legacy rather than going through constant cycles of trying to fix it afterwards.
Malcolm, you've also been very successful in DEFRA's recent SR bid into the Treasury to address legacy. And you've spoken on that. You've spoken on the importance of learning from previous mistakes. How do you think leaders can demonstrate examples of failure as positive evidence and build a best practice understanding across HMG?
There's some points to unpack here about learning from previous. So one is that actually the SR process, we've been in a fairly unusual situation in the last 3 years where we've run an SR process in 2019 and one in 2020 and are due to run one in 2021. And normally they only turn up every few years. And the biggest thing we have to learn is how to not lose the great work we've done in previous SRs, where we've built up the story from the bottom up, from the top down, And it's then got to that sort of crunchy bit in the SR where the reality of the amount of money that is available has become realised, and we start getting a race to the who's got the biggest legacy debt problem, which kind of unwinds the last sort of 2 or 3 months of aiming for the really good stuff like commonisation of components and platforms, the digital products of the future, automation, AI, the stuff we should be investing in to make sure that the future is actually attainable. I think you tend to think of this as transformation, sort of transforming a legacy estate, but it's not necessarily the word I'd use is transformation, because I think there's something more fundamental underpinning this. Transformation, I think of as being putting those platforms in place and stretching for the strategic goals. And actually some of this is just about getting the basics right, filling the holes in our estates, and picking up the word that Tom was using earlier about assets. Part of changing the minds of our senior leaders is about talking about those assets and treating them as assets, rather than treating the whole IT function as a cost center where you just kind of pour money into it. And when you start thinking about assets and maintaining those assets, then it changes the behavior, because we recognize that we have to not just run them, but also maintain them and eventually replace them. And that's three different sets of spend that we have to put in place.
I think that's a really good point, that it's often basically seen as a cost center. But you're right, they're assets. But I think it's explaining how important they are as assets, but because of the output that you get from them as assets as well.
Yeah, I think to kind of Malcolm's point as well, and this kind of relates to the question that you asked earlier, Simran, when we think about the number of assets that we have and how these kind of all fit together, government, when we're looking at kind of spending bids and when we're kind of trying to be ambitious about the IT that we manage in government, we want to kind of move into automation and AI and doing sort of more cutting edge things in government and the benefits that those can bring. But you can only do that if the fundamentals are correct, and you can't kind of build a big sort of exciting house on foundations of sand. And I think that a lot of this stuff that can sound a little bit, dare I say it, boring, or doesn't sound very important and is not the really exciting stuff, is what enables the exciting stuff and enables us to be kind of more exciting and cutting edge over time. And that's one of the reasons why this stuff's so important.
I think there's some other perceptions to overcome as well here when we talk to senior leaders. And one is that the IT budget is already quite large. People see it as the largest operational budget they have in an organization. And therefore, surely, with all of that money, we must be paying you enough to keep it in good order. And then whenever we pay you more money, it seems to disappear down a black hole. And we never see the shiny thing that you might get if we paid you a bit more money. And what that's illustrating is, whenever we attract a bit more funding, it addresses some of the technical debt. We patch some stuff, or we upgrade some stuff, or we make some middleware fit for purpose. And actually, at the end user point, at the applications point, they don't see anything different. It's often seen as a target as well. The IT budget is so large, it's perhaps if we trimmed a bit off of that, then we might be able to fund some of the stuff that we're struggling to do in other policy areas. Just defer a bit of IT spend to the right. And the challenge with all of that is, and IT people tend to be very compliant and willing to say, yes, we could manage with 10 million less or whatever it is. And we'll just shove some spend to the right and see what we can do. And the problem there is it leads to a credibility gap that we attract large budgets, and yet the IT is still seen as old and clunky. We're never giving the people what they want, and hence you start getting the question, well, why should we give you more money? The money we give you, you just don't seem to be delivering us the service we want. And I think Tom was touching on something else a little bit earlier, and that's the CapEx versus OpEx, or the CDEL versus RDEL thing. The future of IT is about RDEL. It's about transferring those assets to services and pay per use. And And this doesn't play well politically. You know, politically, we like a big capital project, and we like a shiny delivery from that capital project. And there's also an expectation that when you pay out some CDEL, it translates to a reduction in RDEL. You know, we're going to pay for something which is going to, you're going to pay back by reducing your operating costs in the long term. And unfortunately, unfortunately for those political messages, that's just not the way the industry is going. And the future means we're going to have to reduce those assets and build those ongoing costs. But what it does deliver us is certainty of cost, and it smooths out those reinvestment cycles. And that's got to be good for everyone.
Taking into consideration your role, Tom, I wonder if you could shed some light on how those who are writing the business case and going through the sign-off process can be as streamlined as possible to achieve confidence and buy-in at all those various stages.
The key things that my team are looking at are the kind of technology code of practice, and you can find that on gov.uk, and that's what we work towards. It starts with a focus on user needs, as everything in kind of GDS world does. But it's also one of the most important points from my perspective that I think is often one of the weaker areas is around the procurement approach. It's how you go to market. And how you go to market has such a big impact on everything that we've been talking about today. It's often because of kind of government has found itself locked into particular types of contract that updating legacy IT can be a lot harder than it otherwise would be. And so from my perspective, and I think as well from my commercial colleagues in the government commercial function, it's making sure that you're not just thinking about the life of the contract that you're in at the moment, but you're thinking beyond the life of that contract and what happens after this contract has been signed. And so when a business case comes to us, there's often very good writing, can be a bit variable, but generally very good writing about what we're doing now and why this is important and the value that it's going to bring in the short term. And you know, maybe it's a 2-year, maybe it's a 5-year contract. But what I see less of is an explanation of what happens after that. And the best time to kind of focus on what happens at the end of your contract is at the beginning of your contract. It's not halfway through, because actually decisions have already been made by that point and you've already kind of limited your options. So from my perspective, it's kind of having that long-term view. And it's not about understanding exactly where the technology industry is going to be in 5, 10, 15 years time, because things change. They probably don't change quite as fast as we're told, but they change. But it's more about just keeping options open for yourself at the end of that time. And, you know, so things like around open standards and open source within the technology code of practice, a large element of it is that the kind of further options that you'll have at the end of that contract, if you're not tied into some sort of proprietary solution, and you'll have an ability to kind of move to a different platform or do something different if you haven't tied yourselves into a proprietary platform, for example.
Just to come in on that, I think you've made some excellent points there. And when I've sort of worked with departments on providing sort of commercial assurance to their procurement strategy and plan, what I've found is that because in general, assets are sweated to the last remaining use of their life. What we find is there's a shortened period of time for people to actually make the right decisions and to think about what they want for the future. So they go into almost panic mode and they just look for a replacement, which is often just a newer version of what they currently have, rather than seeing it as an opportunity to really, really do actually some business transformation or look at things in a different way or have an eye on the future. And then this in turn limits their sort of procurement approach and their plan as well. And you can just almost see them making the same mistakes again. Or coming back to some of the points Malcolm said earlier, you go back in to find something just as similar and then you just continue in that sort of patching and fixing things in the whole next cycle.
And sticking on the topic of good results, Beverly, you have an example where an effective process has lent itself to a success story with the Crown Prosecution Service.
Yes, of course. I mean, they were actually in a challenging situation that they did have a short time frame to actually move from their legacy ERP platform to a cloud-based ERP. But I think what they did really well is, in some ways, that pressure did make them put emphasis in the right areas. So they had really strong leadership. They had dedicated personnel on the project management team, really ring fencing the right skill set that they needed in that team. Because what I've also noticed, sometimes when people don't quite get it right, people are almost doing this as part of another job. And actually, you do need quite a lot of dedicated resource when you're going through this process. So they had really strong leadership and project governance. It was led, from the top down, in that everyone was engaged, that this was a critical project that had to be delivered. They did this in sort of a period of 4 to 6 months. They prioritized the sort of human capital management and finance modules first. They were the critical ones to get right. And they put a huge amount of effort and time up front in the procurement process. Even though it was quite accelerated, they did a very good sort of evaluation of the different routes that were open to them. And I think they chose the right route. But they also put a lot of time up front in agreeing sort of sensible, robust and workable contractual arrangements with the third party partners who were involved in the implementation. And that was critical, particularly because cloud ERP is still relatively new in terms of the number of organizations who've adopted and fully moved to cloud-based ERP solutions. So there was a lot of risk around that. So they were very specific about the type of individuals who had to be in the team. And actually spent a huge amount of time on that part of the process before they even got started. And I think that really helps because it gives them a strong framework for measuring against deliverables and also gave the providers the opportunity to sort of be clear on where they felt they could take responsibility and accountability. So I think the balance of risk and accountability across all parties was sensibly distributed. And they also put a lot of time and focus and actually resources on the back end of the implementation, which was really about engaging stakeholders and users, making sure that they were engaged quite early on and knew what was happening and felt part of it rather than they just get a system at the end and they have to use it. So I think putting they used external support for the training element, but actually the sort of engagement was very much led and delivered internally. By stakeholders in the organization, which I think helped with the buy-in as well.
Malcolm, in your SR20 bid, how important was the focus and role of users in making that business case compelling?
Yeah, certainly. I think some of the examples I sort of pulled out earlier about the vets is quite compelling and changing the end user process or changing the end user experience gives us a huge amount of internal support when dealing with senior leadership teams. So, as we sort of turn towards SR21, in DEFRA, it's really important that we engage with not just the core department, but all the arm's length bodies and business units around the core department to ensure that we are... we're placing the user at the center of what we're attempting to do. And that as we engage with them, the users understand what it is we're trying to do and buy into the journey that we're on, that it may not be immediate, but we will get there. And part of that is about responding to the changing needs of the department. You know, as machinery of government changes come through and we follow EU exit, then actually we're going to need to be doing different things in different ways. And we the IT function become not a supplier in that, we become a partner in that as we work together to spot what the future should look like and to make it happen.
In your role as CTO, how do you ensure you have a recruitment strategy in place that responds to meeting government's technical skills requirements?
Particularly when we're recruiting people, it's really important that we communicate the mission that we're on, because on the whole, people don't join government for the money. They join government because they buy into what it is we're attempting to do, and none more so than DEFRA, I think. We have a really strong ecological and environmental drive as a department, and people people join us because they buy into the mission, but there has to be something for the IT professionals that join us as well that links it back into what they're attempting to get from an IT career. And I guess nobody really joins the department to become an expert in old legacy technology. You know, that's not the game we're on. So not just for the people who are joining the department, but also the senior leaders. There has to be a sense of light at the end of the tunnel with legacy IT and technical debt. And part of that is about the evergreen state or the modern digital services or the mass move to the cloud or however you want to call it. But we need to help everyone understand that we're not in a continuous cycle of just building technical debt and then attracting a sum that's large enough to remediate it and then building more technical debt. There is a game plan at the end of this where we move to modern digital services. And in talking about that to recruits or senior leaders or when we're asking for money, I like at the moment I'm talking about three time horizons. There is the pretty immediate time horizon where we're spending the money that we got from SR20. The next time horizon is what we're asking for in SR21, and that goes from a continuation of the same through to some of starting to build modern digital services. And then the third time horizon is we can paint a thumbnail sketch of what will exist in the future as we've completed that journey. And part of the challenge is we can't really join up all the dots between those three time horizons right now because of the factors come into play about the inherent uncertainty of what we have to deliver. But part of my messaging is that in the face of uncertainty, you build agility. And it is through building agile common platforms with agile digital services that we can ensure that we might not know what the right thing to build right now is for every process in every ALB in every department, but we can speed up the cycle time to create those things.
Yeah, and I think to Malcolm's point at the beginning around, there's probably a department that does something that you're passionate about. And, you know, kind of DEFRA is a great example of that. But I do also think that now's like a really exciting time to be in government. You know, like, I know that it's been a tough year for everybody and things are kind of very complicated, but there's actually a kind of, there is this sort of light at the end of the tunnel, and there is growing in most departments at the moment, the sort of foundations that I was talking about earlier that will be able to be built on to kind of actually bring much more exciting tech into government. And obviously, you know, we're not talking about some of the most expensive, exciting tech in the world, but we are talking about sort of tech that can solve real problems for real people. And I think that there's something kind of so rewarding, both working in a place that does solve those problems, where you can actually see that something that you've designed is better and might be a couple of steps removed from it, but actual people are kind of having a better experience because of the work that you've done. But also the scale that you get to work at in government when you're dealing with those problems is massive. And there aren't that many sort of, even a small startup, you won't get that sort of breadth of affecting real people's lives and making them better, often some of the most difficult times of their lives. And that to me is the kind of big attraction that we've got for technology people coming into government. And it can make, you can really make a difference. Sounds cheesy, but it's true. And you can actually see that difference being made.
So just on that, what are your top tips on getting buy-in to recruit multidisciplinary teams? And what about when you only need them for a short period of time?
So we're kind of increasingly trying to reduce the reliance on external contractors that we have. But I think there's a recognition that there'll always be a need for contractors, partly to kind of get in, you know, as you say, sometimes kind of very short-term teams for specific outcomes. And also sometimes to get the very specialist requirements that a particular department might have or a specific program might have. But I think a lot of the time, it's that longer-term view of how how we continue to sort of build a pathway for people joining the civil service where they can have a career that works through these kind of various different areas. And so they can join as a sort of junior user researcher and they can grow and gather more and more skills and kind of get to be a sort of senior user researcher and hopefully then move up into senior civil servant roles, because I'd like to see a lot more user researchers up in those types of roles, if I'm honest. And same with a lot of other technology roles. Multifunctional teams is not just a bunch of technologists or kind of technology adjacent people, but it's also bringing in those specialists from other places in the organization. So they might be legal professionals, they might be policy experts. There's a lot of different people who need to be in the room.
And I guess the people we recruit go on to be end users or go on to be the interface between those at senior level and the end user.
I think Tom's really hit a nerve with me. I think his description of multifunctional teams working best is definitely my experience from working in the public and private sector. When teams are brought together in that way, there's so much richer for it. And I think communication is improved because it can be filtered across, down through all those different functions involved in that team.
I wanted to open this out to all three of you, really, a bit of kind of future scoping. So it's SR21. You're putting in a bid for X amount of money to mitigate the risk of legacy IT. So be that in the replacement of a technology system or the complete decommissioning of one. What is your top tip advice to get that green light? Malcolm, let's start with you.
Great, thanks. what's my top tip? I guess what we've learned from the past is that we need to, in our engagements with HMT, we need to show the whole strategy, not just the first bit of that strategy. So if we are asking for money, it's going to be largely for a multi-year plan. And when you ask for the first part of that multi-year plan, it has to be something that achieves an outcome in that year, because otherwise, we start to suspect that it's not delivering. But also it has to be part of a longer-term strategy that is demonstrable and will lead us towards our strategic aims.
Yeah, and I think to build on Malcolm's point, like being able to tell a story of how a department or how a team have done that in the past as well goes a very long way with Treasury. Being able to show, yes, we want to transform this system because over the last 3 or 4 years, we've transformed this system and this has been the outcomes of it and they've been great, is a really great story to kind of sell to the Treasury for the next time around. It's a lot harder if you're starting from scratch and you're asking for more money for a program that perhaps hasn't kind of delivered as well as it might have done.
It's good to reference successes, but not to be afraid of referencing I don't want to use the word failures, but things where they haven't quite gone to plan, because the good thing about referencing those is showing that you've picked up the learnings from those and how you're going to do things differently. And again, it just shows that you've done your research, you take into account all the different risks and pitfalls that could happen, and you're already looking as early on as possible how to mitigate these or address them. And it's similar, particularly, there's challenges, for example, around the move to cloud. It's been around for some time, but there hasn't been that many adoptions in the private sector as well as public sector. So we're kind of being pushed into sort of early adopters, which introduces risk around that, because especially when we're going out for third-party partners to support, they don't have that much experience either. So we're all still learning.
I think one of the advantages of the compressed SR periods where we've done SR19, SR20, and then SR21, is that we are able to have that continuity of story, and in a way that we were not when the SRs were separated by a few years. And it felt like we had to start from first principles every time. Almost make excuses or tell the story or do some spin for what had happened in the past and how it was all going to be different this time. I'm not saying that we should continue to have an SR every year for perpetuity, but actually that greater frequency in conversations with Treasury and greater continual accountability for how we spend the money is a good thing to have.
And that brings us to the end of this podcast. Tom, Beverly, Malcolm, thank you so much for your contributions. There's some great examples there and advice of how we can support leadership to address legacy IT and look to real digital transformation for HMG. Within this series, we also have two other podcasts, with one looking at how to get yourself out of a legacy IT contract and to stop it happening again, and one looking at why end users are key to solving legacy IT and moving to digital transformation. We encourage you to listen in to get a real feel for ways in which government organisations can make the best of digital transformation. For further information and support on any of the points raised in this podcast, please contact the Central Digital and Data Office.